Yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in to say you're listening. After 34 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be confirmed anymore. And sometimes we get reports from people by Echolink and IRLP that are in different states, in different countries, quite far out of the immediate area of New York City. This particular repeater has great coverage of the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. But by way of those electronic means, it has connections a lot further. So, give me your call letters and name right now if you want to check into the TechNet. K2RIW listening.
N2AQH, Andy, Queens, New York, and yes, I have a question, and it's not about antennas. N2AQH, call to the repeater.
KD2HUC, Steve, and yes.
I'm back and listening.
Okay, I heard Andy, HUH, blank, a person who I'm going to pick up right now, followed by Steve, KD2HUC. So who is the second person who signed in right after or with Andy?
HYY Joe, yes.
Okay, so in the order of sign in, we had Andy, Joe, and Steve, HUC. Who's the next person who wants to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
KD2IBP.
K0SJG. Name is Sonny. And yes, I have a question.
Okay, KD2 India Delta Papa. His name is Ray. And Ray never gives his name to anybody, even though they keep requesting it. And then K0 Sierra Juliet Lemur, I think it was. Can't even read. Sonny. Okay. So we got Ray and Sonny. One last call. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
I apologize. The call is Kilo Zero Sierra Juliet Golf.
Sierra Juliet Golf. We got you right that time, Sonny. One last call. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
This is KD2KGD. The name's Tommy.
Okay, Tommy. Was that Kilowatt Golf Delta? Is that correct, Tommy?
That's correct. Kilo Delta 2, Kilo Golf Delta. Correct.
Okay, we got you, Tommy. Andy, you're number one on the runway. You've been cleared for the rollout. Take off. N2HUH, K2RIW. You got it, Andy.
Thank you, Dick. And the question I'm about to ask, if you've already covered it in another TechNet, I'll be very happy to refer people to listen to it. Or if you don't wish to discuss it here, you can. Maybe we could do it on the Astronomy Net, but I usually can't join that net because I'm working usually. Things do change, especially with me. However, when I'm doing astronomy, as you know, I like astronomy, they ask me, I'm being asked questions about the moon. Like, did we really go there? Usually from people that don't think we went there or have doubts. And some of their arguments from some intelligent people, I believe, or some very bright people are actually, I don't have an answer for them, but I can't remember specifically. But if you know some of the questions or that people ask to say or to try to prove that they don't think we went to the moon or actually to at least man was walking on the moon, like maybe we dropped something off there, but we didn't actually land there and walk around and do dances on the moon or something along those lines. And everything from how can you get past the Van Allen belt with a tinfoil uniform on to all kinds of speculations or different theories, but I can't answer those questions, it seems, and I feel bad that I can't, and at least maybe next time I could if I knew some of the, let me let it drop.
Well, you've given me more than enough information. Stand by here, Andy. Now, we've briefly discussed the subject, a couple of years ago. If you Google the word evidence that the Apollo moon landing really took place, you Google those words, or words like that, you'll find a whole lot of pieces of information. Particularly independent observers, and you look down the list of independent observers, you'll find a guy named K2RIW listed on Wikipedia on that subject, the fact that with independent equipment in Farmingdale, Long Island, he listened to Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 by taking a high-gain 12-foot dish antenna with a 3-degree beam width at 2287.5 megahertz, 2 gigahertz. Aim that 3 gigahertz antenna, that 3-foot, 3-degree beamwidth antenna at the moon, and listen to the astronauts, listen to the command module, the lunar rover car, the ALSEP, Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Packages, and when they left the moon, and were on the way back from home, the first day, the astronauts were 7 degrees to the right of the moon. The second day, they were 14 degrees to the right of the moon. If somebody was going to go out there in space, emit a signal from those directions at that frequency, at those power levels, with that Doppler shift, in order just to keep me convinced that this hoax was taking place, but it really was a hoax. As you can see, no way in hell. Let me drop this. There's a huge number of people who got some kind of an idea, crackpot idea in their head that the Apollo mission never took place. The Apollo mission invested $31 billion in 1970 money to create all that hardware. Probably 100,000 human beings were involved in that effort. You add together all of the vendors and all of the states. In order to get that project approved, each of your congressmen made sure that almost every single congressional district in the United States had something to do to contribute to that effort. If that was a hoax and you had to keep 100,000 people keeping the secret, can you imagine the chances of doing that? Yes, when the astronauts are on the moon, people would say, hey, I don't see the stars in the background, for a very good reason. The moon is a very bright object being lit by the sun at high noon. So you get this bright white spacecraft, bright white astronaut uniforms on a fairly bright moon, and when you set the camera correctly so it doesn't overexpose with those objects, no way in hell is it going to see the stars in the background. You only see the stars in the background when your eyes are dark adapted. You just walk out from a brightly lit room, and at first you won't see the stars in the sky. So there's a huge difference with star brightness versus local terrain. So the fact that you don't see that is one of the things bugging people. The fact that the flag stuck out, even though there's no wind. Well, there was a piece of wire inside of that flag that the astronauts were setting up. Let me drop it. The moon is 250,000 miles away. That's a long distance. You take the best telescope at that time we had on Earth, the 200-inch diameter Mount Palomar. You think that's an extremely high-gain telescope. It is. You aim it at the moon. You can see some very fine details on the moon. Up to objects that are 300 feet in diameter. You can resolve objects that are 300 or 350 feet in diameter using the Mount Palomar telescope when it aimed at the moon. Well, the astronaut, the spacecraft they're on and whatever was nowhere near that big, so you're not going to see them directly. There are lunar orbiters that have taken pictures of each of the websites, and each of the landing sites. You can go to various websites and you can look at those photographs taken with the high-gain cameras on lunar orbiters. So, let's see now. A hell of a lot of people around the world had their radio telescope aimed at the moon at the right time, heard those signals coming from the astronaut. Bochum University in Germany was one. K2RIW in Long Island was one. All of the NASA sites. There was also another ham having trouble remembering his call letters in California with his independent equipment was listening to lunar signals. So the chances of all of that being a hoax are not even one chance in a million, Andy. The fact that there were some very intelligent amateur radio operators, some of them members of this club at a time, were absolutely convinced that that it was a hoax. And when I told them what I personally observed, that particular guy got very angry at me because he thought I was part of the conspiracy. So you get all kinds of people coming up with crazy opinions, and if they dig deep enough, there's an awful lot of evidence, Andy, so there's no doubt. And I'm one of the believers. I was there. I heard those signals.
Repeater, time out.
And when those, when the lunar orbiter was above the moon with, let's see, Armstrong and Aldrin on Apollo 11 went down to the moon, and all of a sudden I have trouble thinking his name, the guy who stayed in the lunar orbiter. When the lunar orbiter is going around the moon,
that's Mike Collins.
Yeah, Mike Collins, exactly. When he's going around the moon, as he goes around the moon on the left side, clockwise top view, you hear negative Doppler shifts. The signal fades out as he goes behind the moon. You hear him come back 45 minutes later from the right-hand side of the moon. You hear positive Doppler shifts as he's coming toward you, and so on. And since I knew the uplink frequencies during the time the lunar orbiter is in the middle of the moon, and Goldstone's 240-foot dish is aimed at that spacecraft, 99% of the signal is missing the spacecraft hitting the moon, and I was hearing the uplink signal by way of moon bounce at that time. So you can see there's a zillion ways that can be confirmed. You probably have some further questions as to what I observed and what other people observed, Andy. It's a good question. And so no matter what explanation you give to a person who is really radically convinced that he's right, he'll find alternate explanations as to why he's not going to believe you. So taking a person who has taken years of his life believing it was a hoax, you're not going to convert him overnight. There's some possibility you can't even convert him in a lifetime. A number of us people fall under the category, my mind is made up, don't confuse me with any more facts. At 2HUH, good question, Andy. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, if I do say so myself, that people do constantly tell me I have good questions, but anyway. Okay, now, from sometimes I'm asked a question from people that know nothing or don't appreciate the, they don't appreciate radio and the things that we know. So even I said, well, you know, it would have been nice to put something on the moon that reflects, but and I said, of course, yeah, and well, if they say it, I said, well, then yes, of course, it would have to be huge because the moon is so bright, what's going to be brighter than the moon? But then even I thought to myself, well, then maybe why couldn't they put something in it on when the moon is dark or it's phasing in and that we can see? But then I said, well, yeah, and even then I said, well, I'm asking the question myself, or if they ask it, if I have somebody that may have answered, I said, well, it has to be huge. It has to be like a mile in diameter or a mile wide to see it with your binocular or your telescope from your telescope from Earth, and it would have to be huge or extremely bright, even if it was, which would say the dark side of the moon, or when it's only a crescent moon, it would have to be extremely bright or an extremely large, I guess. But and even if it was, people would say, well, smarter people might say, well, it was just brought there by a probe. Let me let it drop.
They did put a reflector on the moon, Andy.
I know that, but go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, they put a retro reflector in the moon, but it's only a couple of square feet. So with the right kind of a telescope and aiming a laser beam at it, you can easily see the echo from that retro reflector. And on Apollo 12, 14, 15, 16, 17, they deposited ALSEP packages, Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Packages, which emitted an individual signal on a frequency of 2.1 gigahertz. I listened to those signals from those packages on the moon. Yes, they could have been deposited by another spacecraft. But each one was announced ahead of time as to which Apollo mission is going to launch, is going to leave, which ALSEP packages, what frequency they're on, and I listened to those. So you're never going to perfectly convince somebody. But so the fact that you can't see it directly by way of a telescope on the Earth, that gives them a little bit of a problem. However, that's physics. You can't resolve anything smaller than roughly 350 feet in diameter with the Mount Palomar telescope at that time. K2 can some of the more modern telescopes now resolve those packages on the moon? I think they can, the lunar lander and the lunar rover and so on. I think they possibly can, or at least come very close to it. And you're saying the back side of the moon or the dark side of the moon? There is no dark side of the moon. There is a back side of the moon from an Earth-based observer. But if you wait for a whole month when the moon goes all the way around the Earth, every bit of that moon, backside, front side, top, bottom, it all gets illuminated by sunlight at some time during the 28-day lunar day of the moon going around the Earth. So, by the way, those astronauts had to land at a very specific place on the moon on each one of those repeaters.
Time out.
They had to land at a very specific place on each one of those six lunar landings, which was at the place on the moon was approximately at sunrise, because at high noon on the moon, the soil temperature goes well above 150 degrees centigrade, way beyond boiling water temperature. At midnight on the moon, the temperature goes down to minus 150 degrees centigrade. The spacesuits the astronauts were wearing couldn't possibly tolerate that high temperature or that low temperature. So there was a very specific place on the moon where each one of the landings took place at, let's call it sunrise, halfway between high noon and midnight, where the temperature was more like 68 degrees Fahrenheit during that day or two that they were there during the mission. So that's one of the main reasons why we have not colonized the moon. To put a colony on the moon sounds like all you gotta do is deposit the habitat and put the astronauts in it and give them some food. You better make that habitat 60 meters below the surface where the temperature is more constant so that you don't cook them in the daytime and freeze them at night. And how do you establish that facility 60 meters down, in my example, below the lunar surface? So colonizing the moon sounds real simple. You'd be amazed how difficult that is, even though there were six lunar landings. N2HUH for any further information. K2LAW, go ahead, Andy.
Well, I could also just leave it for other people to have their pros and cons, but as far as explaining this, but to the not too so science-minded, I don't think I can answer all those questions, but I could try to refer them to this, the recording of this net, and maybe they can email questions, specifics, and you can explain away and have fun doing so, because I don't think I'm bright enough to explain it, but maybe once I hear the explanations, I'll be able to do it. But even I would say I'm disappointed as an amateur astronomer that they didn't put something up there that even if they dropped it off from a probe, like everybody would say, oh, they just dropped it off, no man was actually there. You can't prove a man was there. I know in your science mind you somehow can do it, but they can't believe it or understand it. And I can't convince it anyway, so like it's a conspiracy theory. But even I'm disappointed, like once a year or once a month or something, there's not something that I can actually see, like a reflection off, let's say I'm looking at a moon that's a crescent, and the dark where it's actually, when it looks dark to us, I understand, no dark side of the moon, but I could see a reflection of light in my telescope and it bring a smile to my face, you know, that sort of thing. A little disappointing, nonetheless. But anyway, I don't have the skills to explain it, I guess. So, and especially not to a six-year-old. So, I'll have to leave that to you, Dick. Take it light, and best 7-3 from Andy and 2-8-2-H.
You're going to have to accept the fact, Andy, that there are certain people with an extremely strong bias. You can give them all the facts in the world, and you might not convince them. There are people who are brought up in certain faiths, certain religions, certain beliefs in science, certain beliefs in conspiracies, like we never really went to the moon. And depending on their environment and the way their brain works, you might not be able to change their mind. You're going to have to accept that. Go ahead and give it a good college try. Give it an effort. But don't blame yourself because you can't convince them. The best scientist in the world can't convince them. Buzz Aldrin, the second man on the moon, met a really serious guy who gave him a lot of flack. About 2 years ago, Buzz Aldrin ended up punching the guy in the nose because the guy was so obnoxious, insisting that Aldrin was a part of the conspiracy and he never really went there. Next person was Joe, W-H-O-L-Y-Y. How are those electrons treating you this weekend, Joe? W-H-O-L-Y-Y, T-2-L-A-W in the tech net.
And I did wait for all the beeps.
Okay, the question is something you've covered before, but I'm having a problem with part of the formula. And the question is related to the RF path loss formula. And I believe you said it was 36.6 plus 20 log of the distance and mileage plus 20 log of the frequency in megahertz. Well, the part of the formula I'm having a problem with, if you take one, for example, like 1 mile or 1 megahertz, the log of that on a calculator comes out to be zero. Am I doing something wrong?
Absolutely not. Logarithms have got a peculiar characteristic. The log of 1 is 0. The log of 0.9, a little bit below 1, is a negative number. The log of 0.1, 1.1, a little bit above 1, is a positive number. But right at 1, log is 0. So 1 mile away at some particular frequency, of the three components you're going to add together, 36.6 plus 20 log F plus 20 log D, the 20 log D turns out to be 0, and you're adding 0 to the three components at that particular range. You're not doing anything wrong. That's the peculiarity of logs. So you're doing it right, Joe, even though it looks strange at first. You have to get used to the crazy characteristics of the way logarithms work. The reason is 0. Is because log is really exponential mathematics. Any number in the world raised to the zero power equals 1.0. 5,421 raised to the zero power, crazy way math works, exponential math, equals 1. Even if I raised 1 to the 1 power, it equals 1. The next question is, what happens if I raise 0 to the 1 power? It's not clear, but I think it's also one. Over to you, Joe. You're not doing anything wrong. W-H-O-L-Y-Y. W-H-O-L-Y-W. You just got to get used to it.
Okay, very good. Thanks for the answer, Dick. W-H-O-L-Y-Y.
My favorite calculation to make is for the Voyager spacecraft. It was launched 1977. What is that, going on 40 years ago? It's out there three times the distance to Pluto, 12 billion miles away. The signal going out to Voyager and coming back, the round trip point time at the speed of light is 37 hours at the speed of light. Is that a long delayed echo? And NASA, by way of the 240-foot dish and 10 kilowatts of power, they probably probe Voyager probably once every single week for the last 40 years. Hey, Voyager, how's it going out there? What do you see? And are you seeing the solar wind? Are you seeing the galactic wind? How strong is it? Let me drop it. You plug in 12 billion miles. You plug in 8.5 gigahertz. That's the frequency that Voyager is working on. 8.5 gigahertz is 12 billion miles away. You plug it into that formula, and you come up with a free space loss of something like 315 decibels. That means the signal that goes there that you launch one way, how much weaker is it? The ratio of what it gets for what you each issue is 10 raised to the 31.5. 10 raised to the 31. It's a number with 31, almost 32 zeros after it. Is the ratio of the signal you transmit versus what Voyager gets. That's a huge number. A state-of-the-art anechoic chamber that I worked on at Edwards Air Force Base, it cost $63 million. A 300-foot square anechoic chamber, 7 stories high, built out of quarter-inch steel plates, all welded together. All the welds were checked for, make sure they had no bubbles. That chamber has a shielding characteristic of 100 dB. It's a 100 dB tempest-proof anechoic chamber at Edwards Air Force Base, $63 million. Arguably the biggest anechoic chamber in the world. Let me drop it. So that's the best anechoic chamber with the best shielding you can get. 100 and some odd dB of shielding. I worked on that chamber in 1990. In theory, I was one of the first guys to help tune that up. And in order to measure the signal strength that Voyager gets at full range, 315 dB, you'd have to take that $63 million chamber with 100 dB of loss, 100 dB of shielding, and build three of those chambers inside of each other in order to measure the sensitivity of Voyager. I'm exaggerating a little bit. Just gives you an idea. As you have heard me say so often, you launch a signal in space. You launch a signal from your antenna. It goes to every cubic meter or every cubic centimeter of this universe. You can't stop it from doing that. Even in the null direction, there's a little bit of signal going out there. The only thing left to discuss is, do you have a sensitive enough receiver out there to receive that signal? It goes everywhere. It never stops. You can't make it stop. So radio's got some real magic to it. And that by far is the longest range piece of electronics or hardware that mankind has ever issued. It's going to take us many decades to top that particular effort. That traveling wave tube out there, let me drop it. Still, that traveling wave tube is still putting out close to 10 watts of power 40 years later, fed by a nuclear power supply. Because when Voyager looks back at the Earth and the Sun, at that distance, the Sun is just a minor star and Earth is invisible. And that dish has to be aimed to the nearest fraction of a degree in azimuth and elevation. It's got a real high gain, 40 some odd dB or 50 some odd dB of gain, pencil beam. And if that Voyager doesn't have precise aiming to aim that signal directly at the Earth direction, and by the way, is it aiming at the Earth or aiming at the Sun? At that range, it doesn't matter. It's the same direction. If that beam width doesn't hit the Earth, then you're not going to hear that signal. So, beautiful piece of hardware. The fact that that chunk of electronics can precisely aim itself 40 years downrange, has enough consumables on board after all of these years to do that. Their definition of success was 3 years of operation, and here they are 40 years downrange still using it. Next person on our list was Steve, KD2HUC. What big chunk of electronics would you like to talk about tonight, Steve? You got it, K2RIW.
Previous.
I heard the word previous. Go ahead.
Dick, KD2FIU, George, who made the module that you were just talking about that is 40 years old?
I'm pretty sure, which division of NASA is what you're asking? Who is the leader of the project? I one time knew various modules on board were built by various subcontractors, but the overall project manager was the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Pasadena, California, I believe was the prime contractor. So they did an extremely good job. And the actual traveling wave itself, if I had to make a guess, I would guess that was a Varian product. They made very good traveling wave tubes at that time. That's a pure guess on my part. But by way of Googling Voyager, Voyager number one, Voyager number two, that information is available to you, George. KD2HUC, K2RIW. Go ahead, Steve.
Hi, good evening, Dick. My question tonight is regarding ladder line, you know, either 450 or 300 ohm ladder line. I've heard it discussed numerous times on the TechNet of being extremely low loss, and that it, you know, you have to give some careful consideration to how it's routed and how it's used. So I have a theoretical question that would apply to my installation. Let me let it drop. In my installation, I have about 80 feet of underground PVC conduit. So my question to you is, what would happen if you pulled in ladder line into an underground non-metallic conduit? This is strictly theoretical. You know, I don't think I would do it, but the question kind of, you know, it's kind of there. What happens? How does the soil, how would the earth affect the performance of ladder line if it was pulled into a conduit on the ground? KD2HUC, back to net.
Yeah, in the middle days of ham radio, 1940 or so, ladder line was a very popular transmission line. Coax cable was just barely being invented. It was very expensive, so we didn't have coax. Almost all the transmission lines we used was some form of twin lead. And 400 ohm and 600 ohm ladder line were very popular in the 40s. And it's got extremely low loss. And because even though the lines look like they're very far apart to your and my set of eyes, those wires are very close together wavelength-wise. When you're on 20 meters with a wavelength of 60-some-odd feet, and that ladder line is has a spacing of, what, about 4 inches? That's, one 200th of a wavelength is the separation between those two wires. As far as that radio wave is concerned, those two wires are laying on top of each other, and they do no radiation. It's an extremely well-shielded product. Very low loss, very well-shielded. Four nearby phenomena, but there's a catch. If you now go the next step, you go to the right website and you ask for what do the field lines look like in cross-section for a piece of ladder line, you'll see a significant amount of E field and H field goes beyond the vicinity of the two wires. So there is a field. If your two wires are, let me pick a number, 4 inches apart for 600 ohm ladder line, and you look at the fields around that when it's transmitting a signal, there's a significant amount of field, probably 4 inches in every direction from each one of the wires. There's a significant amount of signal. Just as long as you put no lossy materials in that vicinity, the ladder line will keep its low loss. Let me drop this. You take a piece of 6-inch diameter PVC pipe, and you put your 4-inch spaced ladder line in it, and the pipe is up in the air, it'll work like a charm. The presence of the pipe, which is a dielectric material, will probably take your 600 ohm ladder line and make it act like 500 ohm ladder line. No problem. It'll work like a charm. You now bury that 6-inch diameter pipe in the ground. And ground is a volumetric lossy material, particularly when it's wet. And all of a sudden, that very low loss of your ladder line, because those fields are now going out beyond the vicinity of the wires, into the PVC pipe, beyond the PVC pipe, into the earth, you're now lighting up the earth, you're warming up the worms, and then now it's going to have a significant amount of loss. And would it be more lossy than a piece of coax? Good question. There's ways you can research that. But as you can tell, there's a definite mechanism for loss. Now, if you were smart enough to take your ladder line and put it into a piece of 6-inch diameter PVC pipe, and then mount that 6-inch diameter pipe inside of a 10-inch or a 12-inch diameter piece of pipe, and keep one piece of pipe centered from the other and bury that in the ground, you've now got a very low-loss transmission line. But before you go through all of that effort, for a person of your resources, Steve, I'd go out and buy a piece of 3-inch diameter heliax or inch and 5/8 diameter heliax, and that you can directly bury. So if you really want to bury your transmission line, there are various kinds of hard line you can buy, that are made for direct burial. And so because of the degree of difficulty, ladder line in that application may not be the right approach. Over to you, Steve, K2LIW in the TechNet.
All right, yeah, that answers the question. I kind of figured that, but 9 times out of 10, when I kind of figure something, there ends up being some magic where I'm wrong. So for those us guys who go underground with our lines, coax is it. And I actually do have a couple of pieces of a half inch hard line in the conduits. But I was just curious what would happen if I attempted to use twin line, and I guess it's a no go. All right, thank you, Dick. KD2HUC, back to net.
Yeah, arguably the least expensive, very low loss transmission line you and I can lay your hands on is 3/4 inch, 7/8 inch CATV hard line. It comes in 5,000 foot reels. When there's 150 foot left at the end of the reel, they don't go down the block and use it with a splice. They just send that reel back to the stockyard. So you go to a stockyard that stocks all the equipment for cable TV systems, and you make a friendship with the guy who runs the stockyard. For a very small nuisance fee, You can roll away one of those 150-foot reels of a hard line, and quite often essentially free of charge. And that is made, most of those hard lines are made for direct burial for 20 years. And the fact that it's 70 ohms, don't worry about it. It's got very low loss at the frequencies you're likely to use it at. Putting connectors on the end of it's a little bit of a problem. There's ways you can take the stinger that goes on the end and adapt it to your type N or type UHF connector. I've done that. The signal you're listening to me right now, going up my 100-foot tower, is going through a piece of a 3/4-inch, 70-ohm hardline, where I made homebrew connectors on the end of it, and I installed it on my tower, oh, let me think, 20-some-odd years ago, still using it. So there's all kinds of hardline cable you can buy these days that are made for direct burial. Next person on the list was Ray, Kilo Delta 2, India Delta Papa. You've got it, Ray. K2IW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Very knowledgeable crew out here today. So much information. Very fascinating stuff. How many of you guys remember Radio Row back in the 60s over in Lower Manhattan? That was a little bit before my time on radio. I was curious to know if any of you guys remember that, if you have any stories regarding that. Back to you, Dick, KD2IPP.
Ray, I cut my teeth in ham radio in February of 1956. 16 years of age. Just got my novice license in February. Got my general license in April or so. Had to go down to New York City to 748 Federal Building, 641 Washington Street, in order to take the general class exam. And eventually went back there for an extra class exam. Let's see now. Radio Row was Greenwich Street, was one of the streets. I'm trying to think of the names of the street. I visited Radio Row on a number of occasions. In those days, in the 50s and 60s, there must have been 30 separate stores selling surplus radio equipment. I mean, things like an altimeter off the front, off the instrument panel of an airplane, RF ammeters, transformers, tubes, oh, like they're going out of style, 807, 813 tubes, 866s, 584s, and so on. Let me drop them. I can't think of some of the other streets besides Greenwich. You guys, in a few minutes, I'm going to pass it over to you guys to give me the names of some... Okay, that was a quadruple. Andy first. Andy, name some of the streets that were in Radio Row. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, and I have a lot of those radios from Radio Row. Good evening. I'm in the car. Canal Street, Corbin Street, Greenwich Street, Chambers Street, to name a few, and a few others. And I even have in my possession an APX-6, which I converted to 1296 way back when. There was an article in QST about it, which came out of Radio Row, by the way. But I didn't go directly to me. Back to you.
Those are the streets. Canal, Cortland, Greenwich, so on. And the APX-6 and the ARC-5 radios, these surplus radios from World War II. Boy, there were zillions of them down there at ridiculous prices. And some of the hams down there would go and stuff their pockets and steal things. But each of these vendors had so much stuff, they almost didn't even get angry when you stole things, if you know what I mean, within reason. So, boy, was there stuff available at that time. But all that got wiped out. That became the World Trade Center. And life has changed. But 4CX-150, 4CX-250B tubes, 807s, 813s, 866 rectifiers, mercury vapor rectifiers, ARC-5s. The tuner inductor that was in an ARC-5 made a beautiful antenna tuner assembly, for instance. So thousands of dollars of brand new equipment was being sold down there for you know, $5 and $10 at a time, sometimes even cheaper. Resistors, capacitors, transformers. So Radio Row was fun. Unfortunately, it no longer exists. So, good nostalgia type stuff, Rudy. 82 IDP. You don't know what you missed. K2RIW, check that.
Get Edley's in Levittown.
Yeah, there's one, two, or three surplus stores still left. But not many anymore. Okay, the next person on the list was Sonny, Kilo Zero, Sierra Juliet Golf. Go right ahead, Sonny. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, good evening. The name is Santo, but the handle nickname is Sonny. I'm coming through via Echolink. My question, I can't seem to get a straight answer on this one. I've asked many people it, and I get different theories, and I'm not sure how to fix this problem. This is concerning RF interference from a plasma TV or an LCD, or liquid memory TV, LCD TV, flat screen. For the longest, I've tried to filter this noise out. When the TV turns on, it doesn't affect 2 meters, it doesn't affect 70 centimeters, it affects HF radio frequencies, particularly 10 meters. And for the longest, I've tried all sorts of theories and ideas on moving the antenna around, getting a low-pass filter, installing that, running the radio off of a car battery, because I thought the noise was coming through the electrical, through the wall, through the power. My wife came home, turned the TV on, and I literally was going crazy for months trying to figure out where this noise was coming from. And one day she turns on the flat screen, and there it was. It just overtakes all the HF bands. It's just a loud kind of a noise, annoying noise. Between an 8 and a 9 on the S meter. And I went on YouTube, I Googled it several times, didn't get very much into any much answers on how to resolve it or how to filter the issue out. But there was a video on YouTube with a man with a... Let me back down a second. A gentleman with an AM pocket radio tuned to no radio station. You know, just AM radio. He turns the TV on, he walks from room to room, and you can hear that noise coming through the AM radio, coming through the RF. I mean, it's just a loud noise through the TV. So my question is, how do you filter something like this out? You know, I went literally nuts, moving the antenna, like I said, low-pass filter, moved the TV around. You know, I even took an 11-meter walkie-talkie handheld. I had to literally walk all the way out of the house, all the way to the street, which is about a good, more than 50 feet to the curb, before the noise starts to go away. That's how strong the RF interference comes through on the HF side. So how do you eliminate something like that without throwing the TV away? This is K0SJG.
Unfortunately, Santo, from Wichita, Kansas, you may have to sell that TV and buy a more modern TV that has OED, you know, diode-type display screen. I am guessing you've got a plasma-type screen. Anyhow, there are various kinds of display screens that run on a high-voltage inverter power supply, and the individual pixels themselves, in some cases, are little bitty plasma devices that create the light, each of the individual pixels, and those are really fluorescent tube arc generators, if you know what I mean. Without building a extremely well-shielded screen around that television, because the display is where an awful lot of the noise is coming from, in my opinion, in order to completely shield that great big display, maybe your display is 60 inches wide and 40 inches high, to completely shield that and all the power supply associated with it, to stop the source of noise from getting out of there, that's going to be extremely difficult. I guarantee there are television sets that do not make that noise. My Vizio brand name, 40-inch or 45-inch, 43-inch, I think it is, digital television that I bought a year and a half ago, doesn't do that. Let me drop it. If some of the earlier television sets had a cold cathode fluorescent tube creating the light, others had the, that's a high voltage noise generator like you wouldn't believe. Some of them also had the, plasma type screens. So that source of noise is so pervasive in volume, so pervasive in frequency response until you get to the microwave frequencies. Stopping it at the source and shielding it is almost out of the question. How in the world they managed to make that television set just barely shielded well enough that it's able to receive the desired signals, probably a well-shielded piece of RG6 or RG59 coax cable with good connectors is required going into that set so that the noise coming into its own front end doesn't kill it. So you've got a tough problem there, Santo. I don't want to make it sound easy. I think you're going to have to sell that set and buy a more modern one. The more modern sets do not do that. But to stop it at the source of your particular set, that's a long shot. If this was a college senior class in electromagnetic interference engineering, and you wanted to do this as a master's thesis project as to what's required to create enough shielding on that particular set, you could spend a good fraction of a year solving that problem, and I only give you a 50-50 chance you could do it at the level that you desire. So that particular set, for your particular application, is a bit of a loser in this situation, Santo. I hope I'm wrong, but that's what I think is the answer. K0 Sierra Juliet Golf, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Repeater, timeout.
Roger that. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Yeah, I was thinking of that too, just throw away the TV. But I didn't want to buy another one and have the same problem, so I wasn't sure. LCD, I think it is, the new one. Should I go with it? Do you recommend like an LCD and not plasma? Is that what I'm assuming to eliminate? Because I can't operate HF at all because of this reason. So, yeah, I've tried everything. I literally went ballistic for a long time trying to fix. It took me long just to figure it out where the noise was coming from. And my wife just came on, turned that TV on, and there it came. And then I says, oh, there it is. You know, it's the TV. So do you recommend an LCD TV or any particular brand name or model number or anything like that? K0SJG.
Question. A person with question, go ahead.
The K0 operator, what did you mention about AM broadcast radio?
Yeah, first of all, tell us what brand name is your set, Santo. And you hear it on all of your HF ham radio frequencies. My guess is you probably even hear it on your AM radio, your transistorized radio when you walk around the room with it. What brand and what screen size and roughly how many years ago did you buy that television set, Santo? K0 Sierra Charles Juliet Golf. Sierra Juliet Golf, K2IW in the TechNet.
Yeah, roger that. The TV, I think it's Samsung. Yeah, it's a Samsung, and it's a flat screen plasma. It was bought about, I'd say maybe 6 years ago, and it's on the wall. You know, it's mounted on the wall, and we have the cable line going to it for the TV, for the reception and everything. No cable box. It's just a direct line going to the TV for basic. And I'd say, what is it, a 30-inch, 36-inch? And that's about it. That's all I can say. But the video that I'm referring to is on YouTube. It's a gentleman with a little AM radio, because I was Googling it, trying to figure it out, and I came across this video. If you go to YouTube, there'll be a man demonstrating it with a little transistor radio, and he's walking from room to room around the house. As he's moving around the house, you can hear it with the radio, with just an AM radio tuned to no station. And I didn't try it that way. I tried it with an 11-meter TV walkie-talkie, and I had to literally walk all the way at least 50 or 60 feet from the house before the noise subsided, and it was coming through that, all 40 channels of the 11-meter handheld. So, you know, for a while I was just trying to figure it out. I didn't know if it was electric coming through the power line. Then I bought the low-pass filter. I said, maybe that'll do it. That didn't work. I moved the antenna to the other side of the roof. That didn't do it. You know, I tried everything. And sure enough, my wife came home, turned the TV, and then I figured out it was the TV. But there was no way I could have filtered that out. I tried everything I can think of.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me, Santo, because the whole down display, radio-wise, is hot. It's one great big arc generator, and zillions of them. If you did a careful measurement with a real good signal strength meter, I suspect you would find a significant difference in the signal strength of the interference from that set, depending on whether or not the picture is a black picture or a white picture on the screen. Guarantee, if you can get your S-meter off the peg, you would see a significant difference. So 6 years ago, Sony set probably was a plasma display or a cold cathode fluorescent tube providing the illumination. And these are extremely big noise generators. The modern day sets with liquid crystal and diode and what is it now, organic diode types, they are a hell of a lot quieter. I recently bought a Visio brand name, V-I-S-I-O, and it doesn't do that. So I think the majority of TV sets you can buy nowadays do not do it. And if 36 inches is your favorite dimension for a display, a 36-inch Visio, you could probably buy that for $130 at a good discount store. You're probably going to want to upgrade to a 43 or a 60-inch set, and for less than $300, you can buy them these days. And the nice thing about buying a brand new set is that you're buying it under a kind of a probably a one-month warranty. In other words, you bring the set home, try it out. If you don't like it, you can bring it back, if you know what I mean. So the modern day sets, the majority of them do not do that anymore, in my opinion, Santo. And when you do go out and buy another set and find out that solved the problem, come back and tell us about
repeater timeout.
HUC with a question.
Yeah, Mr. Steve, HUC. Go right ahead, Steve.
First, I want to say I know Santo's pain because I have the very same problem. I have, it's a Panasonic plasma. It's in an addition which doesn't have basement. It's on a slab, and my radio room is in the basement on the other side of the house. The antenna is on the other side of the yard, and he's 100% right. You turn that thing on and you're not getting HF at all. Is it possible that the TV may be radiating actually through, like, the building wiring? I mean, the chassis of the TV, or at least my TV, is actually steel. The whole backplate is steel. It's not plastic. And I can't imagine how this thing could be radiating so strong as to be hitting my dipole across the yard. How does it even pass the Part 15 FCC rule? KD2HUC, back to that.
Go ahead, Eric.
No, number one, thank goodness you don't see plasmas anymore. Understand that the plasma is a gas discharge device, and it's got these little transistors set up in rows and columns. And when those things switch on and off, they make the really nice square waves, which you can hear for miles. they try very hard to RF shield it, to try and, you know, bring it within Part 15. And as the tubes get older, and as the gas dissipates, it becomes, the rise time of the little switches get even worse, so it gets louder. K2RWK2J.
Yeah, part of the answer, Steve and Santo, is that the power supply that feeds those plasma tubes is noisy. It's an inverter type. It's making lots of harmonics. It might be running at 100 kc rate, and so every 100 kc up the band is making a whole bunch of comb lines if you looked at it with a spectrum analyzer. An awful lot of the interference is coming from the display screen itself. So if your display screen is 36 or 60 inches wide and 40 inches high, every bit of that screen, if you had a small sniffing device on the end of a cable going into a spectrum analyzer and you waved it across that screen, you would find that the whole darn screen is radio-wise hot. So it's one huge antenna with zillions of little noise generators, arc generators, in all of those plasma tubes. So shielding that would be an extremely difficult because it's a very big emitter. All the wiring going to it, the power supply going to it, and the display itself is all radiating signals. So to get rid of that noise, you've got to get rid of that set or turn off that particular set. So the modern-day sets, I think, do not do it. The modern-day sets, although they've got some pretty fast switching, make some guesses, Eric, as to which of the modern-day screens are going to be least noisy from what you know about their principle of operation. KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer, K2LIW in the TechNet, you've got it. KE2EJ, Eric.
I think you're getting old. So am I. KQRIWK2J. Actually, the quietest thing, well, let's talk about the less noisy things first. Half the plasmas we run into LEDs, and they started out with fluorescent tubes behind the screen. And even today, there's still a lot of them. The power supply for that is a switcher. They run anywhere between 50 and 75 kilohertz. And they tend to be noisy too, but most of them are put together pretty well in terms of a well-shielded enclosure. But they still emit a bit of stuff. But the ones that are going to be really quiet, either LED or OLEDs, they don't make any noise at all. I mean, yeah, they do make a little bit of switching noise from the multiplexers switching on and off, but we're talking real low levels here. K2RW, K2AJ.
K2AMZ, up a comment.
AMZ, go ahead.
Hey, Dick. Hello, Eric. With Santo, I had to buy a new television when I was down in Virginia, and my original set that died, it was plasma. Thank God it died. When I went to, in this my case, the Costco store, I brought a transistor radio. Remember those things? And as I went in the showroom, again, at Costco, I brought my transistor radio, and I bought the TV that was the quietest, RF-wise speaking. And again, it was an LED-type set. I forgot the brand name, but you're going to have to get a new set, and bring a transistor with you when you go to the showroom. This way you can pick out the quietest set that meets your specifications, KD2AMZ.
Mike, when you were in the showroom with that transistorized radio in your hand, did you wave it in front of each one of the individual television sets? Did you find that the noise was coming more from the screen itself or the wiring going into the screen? So as you waved that transistorized radio in front of each of these TV sets and you waved it across the screen itself, tell me what you observed in noise amplitude versus brand name and distance and whatever. KD2AMZ, K2LIW, you got it, Mike.
Well, Nick, the one, again, I waved it in front of the screen. I couldn't get at the back, but the back was a metallic shielded screen, so the only place was really the front. And I found, and I just kind of went, you know, like in a zigzag motion across the screen, and it was kind of constant across it, more or less. And again, you were getting RF all over the place, so it's a little tough to make a decision, so I had to take a few guesses, but it worked. There were some sets where I walked near them, and they were just horrible. I just walked right away. Again, I was roughly speaking maybe about 4 or 5 inches from the front of the screen, waved it across the screen. It was kind of constant across the screen. But again, what am I using? I'm using a 1960s El Cheapo transistor radio, if you remember what those things would work.
You've got it, Eric. And Mike, when we pass it over to you, make sure you wait for the beeps. You didn't. Go ahead, Eric.
As the development of the screens went on, and liquid crystal specifically we're talking about here, eventually